it's Friday the 7th of May and welcome to Career 24, coming to you from Seoul. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. Yellow dust has blanketed much of South Korea, leading to Seoul and several other provinces to issue a fine dust warning. We'll have more on the situation in our news briefing shortly. South Korea's consumer prices grew at the fastest pace in almost 4 years in April, according to latest economic figures. We'll take a closer look on Weekly Economy Review later. Then on Movie Spotlight, we'll review a new Hollywood action thriller starring Angelina Jolie that has hit Korean cinemas before anywhere else, as well as a local independent film about a group of young children. We'll have all that and more coming up on today's Career 24. South Korea has been covered by yellow dust, raising fine dust alerts across the country, and unfortunately the meddlesome air conditions are expected to last through the weekend. To discuss this and our other top stories of the day, we're joined in the studio now by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So we had some temperamental weather today, even before the fine dust. Can you catch us up on the latest?
Yeah, after what I would call a pretty pleasant Thursday yesterday, this morning it wasn't the fine dust but rain and hail that kicked off our Friday. But by afternoon, effects of a yellow dust storm from the Gobi Desert in Mongolia and northern China was worsening our visibility, and Seoul's Health and Environment Research Institute issued a fine dust advisory as of 2 p.m. on Friday. And according to the weather agency, an advisory was issued for the capital city, as well as 8 cities and counties in surrounding Gyeonggi Province, as well as cities and counties in South Chungcheong Province at the center of the country. People were complaining of throat pain and eye sore even with the requisite KF masks on. The whole nation, and particularly the western regions, are expected to remain under the influence of dense yellow dust through tomorrow, Saturday. Fine dust levels will remain very bad for the greater Seoul area, South Chungcheong Province, Jeolla Provinces, and Jeju Island, while those for the rest of the regions will be bad. The Seoul city government is urging the elderly, children, and people with respiratory or cardiovascular conditions to remain indoors, and if they must head outside, arm themselves with masks.
Yes, unfortunately, we'll have to expect a smoggy Parents' Day tomorrow for the most of the nation as well. Let's head over to the National Assembly next, where Prime Minister nominee Kim Buk-yeom faced a second day of questioning as part of his confirmation hearing. Today, the focus was on an ill-fated investment made by his daughter's family. Can you tell us more?
Right, and it involves the hedge fund Lime Asset, which, of course, is the country's once largest hedge fund that would go down in infamy for degenerating into a Ponzi scheme that led to a suspension of 1.6 trillion won in redemption last year. The firm also collapsed last year. Fast forward to today, the opposition raising the possibility that President Moon Jae-in's choice for prime minister could have been involved with the hedge fund scandal, as they pressed the veteran lawmaker to explain why his daughter and son-in-law had a suspicious account with Lime Asset Management with exceptionally attractive terms. Here's how the nominee Kim Buk-yeom responded.
The subject of the economic activity in question here is my son-in-law. I think I am being framed, as the discussion is phrased to focus on the family of nominee Kim's daughter. If I evaded laws and took advantage of my power, how would I have been able to come this far? I believe that I was able to come this far as I upheld principles in my life.
A bit of context on the charge against his daughter's family, whose finances Kim's son-in-law, an offspring of a conglomerate family, managed, according to the nominee. They had put in a total of 1.2 billion won and had ultimately fallen victim to the financial scam. But an opposition lawmaker said it was odd that the daughter's family had been just one of a few members of a very exclusive fund that had no redemption fee or prescribed performance reward.
Yes, but the nominee essentially had rebutted by saying that this was not his business. He was also asked about whether he would seek to run in the presidential race as well next year, I believe.
Yeah, so the 63-year-old had served as the Moon administration's interior minister during his fourth legislative term in office and is widely regarded as a conciliator in the regionally divided Korean politics, thus often touted as a potential presidential contender. But he says he's nearing the end of a political road. Take a listen.
대선 출마는 염두에 안 두는 겁니까?
제가 이게
I think that this is my last public office. And not just that, I am physically getting old, as it has been just over 30 years since I entered politics. I'd enter the position with the mindset that this will be my last public service.
Along with Kim Bok-yeom, President Moon has nominated candidates for five other cabinet ministers in what will likely be his last stretch of nominations as he battles low approval ratings, characteristic of a president's late term in office.
And President Moon will address the public on Monday to mark 4 years in office.
Indeed, Monday will be 4 years. And during his 20-minute speech, he's expected to talk on policy priorities for the final year of his single five-year term, as he also takes a look back. After that, he will also take questions from reporters for about 40 minutes.
Let's turn next to the COVID-19 situation here in South Korea. We are remaining in the 500s for a second day.
Yeah, so cluster infections continue in the country. Authorities, though, are striking a cautiously optimistic tone this time, saying that new cases have been gradually tapering off since hitting a peak in mid-April. First, the tally released on this Friday, according to the KDCA, 525 new COVID-19 cases were confirmed in the 24-hour period through midnight Friday. And of the 509 domestic transmissions, some 64% were reported in the Seoul capital region. Nine more people succumbed to the virus. Now, on Friday, the senior health ministry official Yoon Tae-ho noted that daily cases could fall below 500 within the next week or two if the virus's reproduction rate remains under one with no variables. He did say, though, the government will hold a wait-and-see approach as the leveling could be attributed to the Children's Day holiday on Wednesday.
Shifting gears now, unionized delivery workers have voted to stage a strike, demanding that courier firms tackle a move by a large apartment complex in Seoul to prohibit ground floor parking by delivery trucks.
That's right. This vote coming after a months-long dispute between delivery drivers and residents of a 5,000-unit apartment complex in Seoul that required delivery truck drivers to not park at ground level and only use underground parking spaces, which, of course, most of these big delivery trucks cannot reach due to height restrictions. So a national union of couriers associated with the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions said that of the some 5,200 workers who participated in the Thursday vote, 77% had voted in favor of the collective protest. So the union said preparations are complete and that it will be up to its chief to decide when the strike will be staged after taking into consideration related conditions as well as public inconvenience. Currently, some 11% of delivery workers are unionized nationwide. And of that group, some 2,000 people have secured the right to strike.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates, Eunice.
You bet.
Welcome back. We've come now to our Friday segment, Weekly Economy Review. This week, we go deep into South Korea's consumer prices, which grew at the fastest pace in almost 4 years in April. Then we'll delve into the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's comments on possible rate hikes. And we'll also look at South Korea's public organizations indirectly investing into cryptocurrency-related funds. To give us his expert analysis on all of these topics, we have joining us on the line now economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Hello, Professor Yang, and happy Friday.
Happy to be here.
Let's kick off with this week's stock markets. How did the KOSPI and KOSDAQ fare this week?
For Kospi, it fell on Monday, but it rose from Tuesday onwards. It closed today at 3,197.20. For the week, it gained slightly, 0.7%. For the KOSDAQ, same story. It fell substantially on Monday and rose from Tuesday onwards, closed today at 978.30. But unlike the Kospi, it did not gain back the entire amount. For the week, it lost 0.5%. For the Korean won, it closed today at 1,121.80. For the week, it depreciated 0.67%.
Now, our first main topic today, latest data shows South Korea's consumer prices grew at the steepest pace in 3 years and 8 months in April. That's according to Statistics Korea. The consumer price index stood at 107.39 points last month, driven mainly by a spike in the prices of agricultural and livestock products. It marks an increase of 2.3% from a year earlier, the highest growth since August of 2017. Can you give us more details about what led to the rise in consumer prices, Professor?
Okay, well, the biggest reason for the rise in prices was not because prices rose a lot during April and April this year, but because price fell in April and March last year. Mm. Now, remember that these variables look at price changes over 12 months. And we have arrived at the period where we are no longer comparing pre-coronavirus and post-coronavirus, but both figures are now post-coronavirus. And even worse, the numbers that is the beginning place to for calculation has been abnormally affected by the shock over the coronavirus we had last year. So if we look at the inflation rate for just April, not over the 12 months, but just April, it was 0.2%. This is just slightly over the March figure of 0.1%. On the other hand, if you look back on March 2020, the prices fell by 0.2%, and in April, it fell by 0.6%. So what we're comparing now is a period where the prices are really abnormally low because the Korean economy, as well as the global economy, was hit by the coronavirus. So we're starting from an abnormally low place. That's why the figures seem so high. If you look at month-to-month figures instead of figures all over the 12 months, then while this particular 12 months, this includes the bounce back that we had from these unusually low deflation we had last year, and also inflation from periods where we had an unusually hot and unusually cold weather, which led to an unusually high inflation rate. In fact, if you look at month-to-month figures, the highest figures do not come in March or April. It comes in last August and September, where it ran 0.6% and 0.7% for each month, and January and February this year, where it ran 0.8% and 0.5% for just those months. So compared to that, inflation was really not that bad in April. It's just that because of that beginning place was so unusual, it just seems very, very high.
So what does that point to then for the coming months? There are continuing concerns about inflation.
Okay, well, if you want to measure inflation momentum, you want to look at the core inflation, that is inflation rates, which excludes agricultural goods and oil. And Korea core inflation rate was 1.4% over the 12-month basis. Core inflation rate, which excludes food and energy, was only 1.1%. So those are substantially below the 2% target. Now, it did go up slightly, it did go up somewhat from March to April. But again, that is due to those unusual months that we had in the past year. So right now, there does not seem to be signs of very high jump in inflation or extended period of inflation. But I think almost every macroeconomist expects higher inflation toward the latter half of this year. One, we're returning to normality, pre-coronavirus levels. And then secondly, once some countries, especially advanced countries like the United States, achieve herd immunity, we will see pent up demand finally become unpent. So demand will rise up fairly quickly, but supply needs time to catch up. Because of the nature of supply, you need to step up the factories, accelerate the production, but also because many countries which export raw materials and intermediate goods, they will still have the coronavirus. So we do expect a lot of bottlenecks in the production, and that will result in inflation for a limited amount of time. But after the pent-up demand sort of satisfies itself, we believe that the after the pent-up demand is satisfied, demand will go back to normal. And production, of course, as more countries achieve herd immunity, they will go back to normal as well. So we expect the rise in inflation to be temporary, but there are a substantial number of analysts who believe that the rise in demand will be more permanent because the government and the central bank has printed so much money.
Okay, so for now, there is a minimal concern about inflation, but that could change as we approach the end of the year and as the situation changes with vaccines and herd immunity being achieved around the world. Okay, now, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen made some comments during the Atlantic's Future Economy Summit that caused a stir this week. She said that interest rates may have to rise to keep the economy from overheating as President Joe Biden's spending plans boost growth. What do you make of Yellen's comments? Some have criticized her for her comments as being unwise, as it seemed to lead a sell-off in stock markets as well.
Well, a lot of people are saying that she shouldn't have said it, and they're probably right. But comments, the next largest number of comments by economists seems to be, why is the market overreacting so much? Yes, she shouldn't have said it, but she said something that was really obvious. If the economy overheats, then interest rate has to rise. This is something you learn from Economics 101. So why is the market overreacting? One is that, well, Janet Yellen should have known better because she was a member of the Fed Reserve for nearly 20 years, and she was the head of the Fed for 5 years. So she should have known better than to make such comments like that, even if it was so obvious. But then comes sort of the, I wouldn't call it conspiracy, but she must, even since she should have known better, there must have been a reason why she said it. So some people were speculating that perhaps Janet Yellen was trying to pressure the Fed into raising the interest rate or stopping tapering earlier than expected, though I'm not sure if they offering any good reason why. Mm. And then third reason, this is, I think, what makes a lot of people nervous, is that she was signaling that interest rate increase may come earlier than the market expects. Because a lot of people are suspicious that current high stock prices as well as asset prices overall is due to excess liquidity by central banks printing too much money, rise in interest rate may mean that the these asset markets may come tumbling down. So it may indirectly show that markets are really very, very nervous about what's going to happen with the monetary policy and asset markets, because the current high prices are really dependent on the Fed continuing their loose monetary policy. I think the Fed will probably maintain the rates at the current levels for this year because that's what they promised. And unless the situation really changes a lot, it'll probably keep its promise. But they didn't say anything specific about tapering. So there is a good possibility that tapering will start this year.
So, yes, rising interest rates will inevitably happen at some point. So we do need to be preparing for that scenario. But it was perhaps ill-advised for Yellen to make her comments. What does this all mean for South Korea as well, then? What is your outlook for the Bank of Korea's interest rates this year, which currently sit at a record low of 0.5%? How would the Fed's decisions affect the BOK's decisions?
Okay, well, the Bank of Korea has been signaling that it will not raise this rates in the near future either. And if the U.S. maintains its low rates throughout this year, obviously that makes it easier for Bank of Korea as well to retain the interest rate at this low rate continuously throughout this year. But I think there is more and more recognition that maintaining this low interest rate is not entirely good for Korea. Even more than the United States, I think Korea is feeling the adverse effects of the interest rate, which may be too low. First of all, the debt is rising too quickly, not only for the government, but also for households and the corporate sector. And it's rising higher than most OECD countries, and level-wise, it's higher than most OECD countries. Also, there has been concerns about the bubbles in the housing market and the stock market to the greater extent than we see in most other OECD countries as well. And this is in large part due to the loose monetary policy. And perhaps most importantly, the reason for maintaining the low interest rate was to raise investment. But we haven't really seen a rise in investment. And this is true even before the coronavirus. We have seen some some rise in investment in certain industries in the last 4 or 5 years. But that is more dependent on demand rather than interest. So perhaps it's now time for Korea to sort of separate itself from the U.S. monetary policy and, if necessary, raise the interest rate before the United States. But I do not think that the Bank of Korea will be that adventurous.
I see. Okay, there's one more topic I'd like to squeeze in with you, Professor, before we go. It was revealed this week that the South Korean government has indirectly invested 50 billion won into cryptocurrency-related funds in the past 4 years. According to data provided by lawmaker Yoon Chang-hyun of the People Power Party on Wednesday, 5 public organizations, the Ministry of SMEs and Startups, Korea Development Bank, the National Pension Service, Korea Post, and the Industrial Bank of Korea, put in a total of just over 50 billion won into funds that invested in cryptocurrency exchanges like Upbit and BitThumb from 2017 to March 2021. Now, Yuna is saying that these investments contradict the government's skeptical approach to cryptocurrencies. In fact, the finance minister, Hong Nam-ki, said recently that crypto assets are not currencies and have no intrinsic value. What are your thoughts on this scenario?
Okay, well, we've discussed in the past how price of assets are determined. For assets like stock, there is a fundamental portion which is linked to the real economy. For the stocks, it will be the current and future profitability and the amount of solid assets that firm has. That forms the fundamental portion of the price, but also there's expectation portion of the price. This is just people expecting the price to go up or go down because they expect other people's expectations to be the same. I'm reminded of what Keynes said about betting on the stock market. When betting money on who wins a beauty contest, it is important not who I think will win, but who other people will think will win. Mm. So there are a lot of investments, especially short-term investment by large institutions, are not made particularly because this is a strong firm or this is a weak firm, but because they think, well, the price will rise for next 2 or 3 days, or price will fall for next 2 or 3 days. And for cryptocurrencies, there is no fundamental component. In that sense, Prime Minister Hong was right. Mm. It's entirely formed from that expectations, the bubble portion of the prices. But people can make money from guessing whether other people will think that the price will rise or fall. Mm. That was the whole point behind the Keynes short little story. So in short term, betting on how other people feel can be very profitable, and some funds obviously have made a lot of money from that. And if these funds are capable of guessing what other people think, then why not take advantage of it?
Right. So the government really can't be blamed for the decisions that they made there. Okay, we're going to have to end it there, Professor. Thank you for speaking to us and providing us with your thoughts. So we've been speaking to Professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. We'll talk to you next time, Professor.
Let's see you next week.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 18.46 points, or 0.58% on Friday, closing the week at 3,197.20. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 8.31 points, or 0.86%, to close at 978.30. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 4.5 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,121.3 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the other news stories that have been catching people's attention online in Korea today. For that, we have joining us on the line now, Bruce Harrison, to bring us those stories. Bruce, hello.
Good Friday afternoon, Jung-ho. How are you?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. Happy Friday to you too. So, Bruce, what stories do you have for us today?
Jung-ho, today we'll learn about a brutal attack on a Seoul taxi driver. We're then going to talk about the late South Korean swimmer Cho Oryun, and how he's gained the honor to be buried at a national cemetery. And finally, we'll close the day and the week by finding out why countries around the world are worried about a Chinese rocket that was launched into space just last month.
Okay, so as you mentioned, we start with a brutal incident of assault in Seoul that was caught on camera by passerbys. Bruce, can you tell us more?
Yeah, and I saw the video, Jung-ho, of this attack. It's quite terrible. Police are now investigating after a young man assaulted an elderly taxi driver. This case sparked public outrage after the video I mentioned of the assault quickly spread across the internet. This video is dated on Wednesday, and it shows an older taxi driver lying on the road behind his taxi near Nangok Tunnel in Seoul's Sillimdong area. Two other men are seen leaving the driver on the ground, with one even stepping over him. But moments later, one of the men walks back to the driver on the ground and starts attacking him, repeatedly punching his face. In what appears to be a full force, punching him quite intensely. The attacker appears to be quite muscular as well from the video. And even as the police car pulls up, he's still taking swings at this taxi driver on the ground.
Right. I've seen the video myself as well, Bruce. And the fact that the assault took place so calmly and openly on a man who was already incapacitated, lying on the floor, and even as police cars arrived, was very unsettling. So what have police found in their investigation so far?
We're still waiting for more details, Jung-ho. What police do know is that the young man was in his 20s. He was a passenger in that driver's taxi, and he was intoxicated at the time. Police have requested an arrest warrant for the man. That man has also been charged with obstructing the performance of official duties after he reacted violently when police approached him. Police say they've questioned the young man. They plan to talk to the victim as well, that taxi driver who's now in hospital.
Now, after the video went viral, I understand that an online petition was posted on the presidential website regarding this incident.
Yes, a petition has gone up. It was posted on a Friday, and it calls for stern punishment against this man who attacked the taxi driver. Now, according to the person who posted the petition, the young man attacked the driver until he was unconscious and attacked the driver again when he came back to. This was all apparently due to the fact that the driver refused to take the passenger because he wasn't wearing a mask.
Yes, anyone who's seen the video will agree that there's absolutely no excuse for what the man did, and hopefully he will face the full force of the law, even without such petitions. Right, let's put that behind us and move on to our second story now. Bruce, what do you have for us?
Our next story, Jung-ho, it's about the remains of late South Korean swimmer Cho Oryun, who's said to be interned at the Daejeon National Cemetery. The Ministry of Patriots and Veterans Affairs said Friday the decision comes as Cho was eligible to be buried at a national cemetery given he was decorated as a figure who contributed to the nation and society. The ministry plans to pursue the burial in consultation with Cho's bereaved family. He died on August 4, 2009 from a heart attack. He was just 57 that year.
Yes, I believe Cho received the Order of Sports Merit, which is awarded to those who have achieved outstanding services in the interest of boosting national status through sports. So what were some of his achievements?
Yeah, he did receive the Order of Sports merit Jung-ho, not once, but twice. He also received a Mongyan medal, which is a type of order of civil merit. He also won two gold medals in the men's 400-meter and 1,500-meter freestyles in the sixth Asian Games back in 1970. And then he went on to repeat that same feat the following Asian Games in 1974. He also set 50 Korean swimming records, 5-0, thus earning him the nickname Asia's Seal.
Wasn't he also the first ever to swim across the Straits of Korea?
That's right. He swam across the Straits, estimated to be some 200 kilometers long. He did that in 13 hours and 16 minutes on August 11th, 1980. He will be the sixth athlete to gain the honor of resting in a national cemetery.
Yes, an important and incredible pioneer in Korean sports. Let's move on to our final story now, Bruce. What are we looking at?
The sky is falling, Jung-ho. That's an expression that we may need to worry about as countries around the world become worried over Chinese space debris that's expected to fall back to Earth this weekend. The U.S. in particular has expressed concern, projecting that the remnants of a Chinese rocket are expected to come down between Saturday and Sunday. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told reporters that the U.S.'s Space Command is tracking this debris and that he hopes the debris will land in an area where people aren't living so nobody gets hurt. The ocean, he said, would be optimal for that.
Right. Can you tell us more about the rocket? What was it doing up there in the first place?
Yeah, well, China launched this is the name of the rocket, Long March 5B from Hainan Island on April 29th. It was carrying the Tianhe core module of the Tiangong space station that's set to be fully constructed by the end of next year. This launch was the first of 11 missions. The White House also said regarding the latest issue spokesperson Jen Psaki with the White House said the Biden administration is continuing to monitor this debris and wants to work with the international community to promote leadership and responsible space activity.
Now, what's been the response from China on the global concerns of the risk of this debris causing damage on Earth?
Well, the state-run Global Times, an English-language daily out of China, described media reports that the rocket is out of control and could damage, described media reports, the foreign media reports, citing U.S. officials and whatnot, as Western hype. Citing industry insiders, reports of the situation, this is the Global Times language, it's not worth panicking about. The report quoted the chief editor of Aerospace Knowledge magazine, Wang Yanan, as saying that most of the debris will burn up during reentry and leave only a small portion to reach the planet's surface, which will then potentially land on areas away from human activity or in the ocean.
Yes, it's probably very likely that it will just burn up or land anywhere where there isn't people, but I'm sure the relevant authorities will be monitoring just in case. That is all for Korea Trending. Bruce, thank you for those stories, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, John. I'll talk next week.
Welcome back. We've now reached our weekly segment, Movie Spotlight, where we take a look at some of the latest releases here in Korea and discuss the movie industry in more general as well. With me this week are two wonderful film critics. First, we have Jason Bechaves. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Jang. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And we also have with us Darcy Paquette as well. Hello, Darcy.
Hi, Jang.
Now, this week we're covering two new theatrical releases, a star vehicle from Hollywood and a Korean independent film. First up is director Taylor Sheridan's new film called Those Who Wish Me Dead, starring Angelina Jolie. And Jason, this release is quite interesting because it's actually opening in Korea before any other country in the world, I understand.
Yeah, I went to see on its opening day and there were like no reviews. and it opened yesterday in Malaysia, Singapore and in Spain today. I think it's opening in Hong Kong as well. and it roll out across much of the world next week. It happens actually quite a lot here in Korea. We're very fortunate, but because of the coronavirus, a lot of these kind of more major releases haven't happened. But as America is slowly returning to some kind of normality, we're seeing more American films coming out, and Korea is a big market, so films invariably, sometimes get released here, and they often get released on a Wednesday or a Thursday, which is great.
So this is one of the first reviews of the film worldwide.
Exclusive,
yes, exactly. So Darcy, first tell us about the film. What kind of film is it?
It's based on a novel by an American crime writer named Michael Corvita. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he's written 16 novels to date. And actually, many of them have been optioned for movies, but this is the first one to actually make it to the screen. Mm. He worked on the screenplay as well, together with the director. It's a story of a smoke jumper who's played by Angelina Jolie. And smoke jumper being a firefighter who's kind of like parachutes into the fire and is the first to try to control it. Mm. But she is suffering from PTSD after an accident that occurred while fighting a fire that she feels partially responsible for. And then one day she comes across a teenage boy who's desperately running away from something. And it turns out that some men have just, tried to kill his father.
Right. Okay. So it's a bit of an action adventure thriller set amid the Montana wilderness, I understand. Now, Jason, some people may recognize the name of the director, Taylor Sheridan. Can you tell us more about him?
Yeah, he's an American filmmaker. He started out as an actor, actually. His credits include the American series Sons of Anarchy. But I only started taking notice when he started screenwriting, because he wrote the screenplay for Sicario, which is incredible. I love that film. The sequel's not as good, but the script is fantastic. And he also wrote the script for the critically acclaimed Hell or High Water, which is also great. And then he made his debut in 2017 with Wind River, which was very well received here. It stars Jeremy Renner. It's fantastic. It's just there's a real intensity about it, and it's beautifully shot. I mean, the director's really interested in these kind of wilderness settings. Mm. You see that in this film. It was shot, I think, in New Mexico. He's also created the television series Yellowstone, and I think he co-wrote Without Remorse, this Tom Clancy adaptation, which I think dropped on Amazon just a couple of days ago. So he's really active now, particularly as a screenwriter, but also as a filmmaker.
So quite a CV there. Darcy, what did you make of the film?
I quite enjoyed it. It pulled me in from the beginning. I'm not sure what I was expecting in terms of what the film is going to give, because again, there are no reviews out there. We're the first ones to see it. But yeah, it was quite intense. I thought that they were able to maintain tension throughout it. There are a range of different characters who we kind of jump back and forth following, but for me, I thought it was a success.
While looking at the trailer, the film it reminded me of was the 90s action film Cliffhanger, starring Sylvester Stallone. Especially as it's set in the wilderness like this.
Sure, it definitely has like a 90s feel about it. You know, Cliffhanger, like you mentioned, but also like films like Volcano and Dante's Peak.
Right.
You remember those movies? Those disaster kind of movies where you could just leave your brain at the entrance to the cinema.
I'm feeling like you didn't like it as much as I did.
Well, I mean, it's a lot more mainstream. It doesn't quite have the intensity Wind River has. The atmospherics in that film are incredible. You don't get that here. I mean, you get these kind of adrenaline shots, at the beginning of the film and at certain points where it truly is riveting. And it does feel like, this is a HBO Max film. It feels like a feature to try and lure in those viewers. Or, they're not sure what to do on a Friday night, but they want to sit in front of the TV or their computer and watch something that's pretty mindless. And this really does hit all those. It hits the right notes in that regard.
It does seem like that to me as well. It seems like a bit of a B-movie, that sounds like straight to video from the
90s. Sure, but it does it, in that sense, it does it really, really well.
Okay.
And I love the female characters in this film. The sheriff's wife, she's pregnant, and you worry because you got these two assassins that approach her house and go, oh my goodness, what are they going to do? But she can take care of herself, and then she goes after them as well with this rifle. It's hilarious.
But even the title, Those Who Wish Me Dead, sounds a bit cheesy. And the fact that it's, for me, it's almost a surprise to see such an A-list actor like Angelina Jolie in the lead role. Mm-hmm. Darcy, am I being unfair?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I mean, certainly this is a very high-profile director. Mm. And I mean, it's not surprising that she'd want to work with him. And the project itself, I mean, she recently did this kind of online press conference in Seoul where she talked about what sort of connection she felt to the project. And, I mean, I thought she was a really good match for the film.
Right.
Whether or not it's a good career choice for her, I can't say, but I thought that, I mean, the film was better because of her, I thought.
Oh, absolutely. The female characters make this film. You don't really have this kind of male action hero. They're a bit, you know, they don't really have any, you know, great action skills or anything. You kind of expect that. You got this police or the police officer or the sheriff character. And he's a bit lame, really.
he doesn't get to do very much.
Right. And he gets injured. And he's not a particularly interesting character. I think Ethan's his name, the character. But it certainly has some really compelling action set pieces. You see these forest fires and... overall, it's certainly enjoyable fun. I'll watch it again, but it's not Wind River either.
Okay, once again, the film is called Those Who Wish Me Dead and is out now in Korean cinemas. The second film we're discussing this week is based on a popular webtoon or online comic in Korea that ran from 2013 to 2014. It's called Kids Are Fine, and the Korean title is called 아이들은 즐겁다. Darcy, can you tell us more about this one?
Yes, the main character is an 8-year-old boy who lives in Incheon. And as the film opens, he's transferring to a new school. We can see that he's a smart kid and, you know, he's social. He gets along with the other kids. But the other kids don't know that he's in the situation where his mother is sick in the hospital with a very serious disease. And so he kind of sneaks off by himself to visit her in the hospital on most days. And... yeah, I mean, that's kind of the basic starting point of the film.
Okay, so the film is centered around, I understood, a group of young children, as you said, around 8 years old. But Jason, would you describe it as a children's movie?
Well, this is the thing. I was debating whether I should take my son to watch this movie. And because the kids in this film, I think the second year in elementary school, you know, Chodonhakyo, and so exactly the same age as my son, and it starts off on quite an upbeat note. These like really cute scenes, and I think my son would quite enjoy it. But then it gets a bit darker as the film goes along. I was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't take him to see this film. And so yeah, it deals with some really heavy themes, obviously social pressures facing this young generation. But also life and death as well. And I know if I took my son to see this, he's going to ask me a lot of questions. I'm not sure I can answer them very well. But actually, I really like this film. It's definitely part of an interesting trend in Korean cinema. Yoon Ga-yeon is a filmmaker who I hugely admire. She released, The World of Us a few years ago, and then there was that sequel to the film, Uri Jip, or The House of Us. And there are other films as well dealing with issues faced by children, you know, the younger generation. And so often films are told through from the perspective of adults, whereas this film and these other films are told from the perspective of children, which I think is really, really important. But obviously that comes with challenges as well, interacting with your cast and how you get the best performances out of them. And it's certainly not as good as The World of Us. That's an incredibly realistic and very, very clever film, and in terms of narrative as well. This film... It's definitely more mainstream, I would say. Would you agree, Darcy? Certainly the second half of the film feels a bit more contrived, and the kids go on this like trip from Incheon to like the other side of the country, and I'm like, no way, I'm sorry, you kind of, you know, they get on a bus and go 3 hours. I just don't see that happening. But then there are these like really touching scenes when they get down to, where is it? I can't remember, is it Jinju or somewhere? Or?
Well, I forget that.
Watching the trailer, it reminded me a bit of the 80s classic Stand By Me. Is there any sort of comparison there, Darcy? And what did you think of it?
I mean, perhaps in the way that we see the kids react or interact with each other. I mean, Stand By Me, I thought a long time ago, but it's still kind of stuck in my head. But, you know, it's that story of friendship and, you know, kids who kind of venture out perhaps a little further than they should. But how that also brings them together. And to a certain extent, that happens in this movie as well. Mm. I mean, it's not on the level of Stand By Me, and a few things are. But I did like I mean, all the child actors are quite good.
Yeah.
The director, I mean, he said that he did a lot of, he didn't give them the script. Like, you know, he didn't tell them to prepare certain scenes. They just kind of did everything on the set.
Right, improvised.
Improvised way. And
it's great. Well, it's interesting it's interesting how these films also shot during the summer months. Because there's Short Vacation as well, which I think is quite similar. That film premiered, I think, at the Busan Film Festival last year and then went on to Berlin. And so, yeah, part of a wider trend, I think, and really... and Korean cinema is incredibly diverse, and I love these little trends you can see. I mean, Korean cinema has this reputation for having films that are very dark and violent, you know, and grotesque. But actually, and this is why I tell my students, it's incredibly diverse, and you got this really interesting collection of films that which are really enchanting and charming. And as a father, I really, really like this film. And yes, it is very mainstream and a bit contrived in places. It's not perfect, but I fell in love with it.
Right, once again, it's called The Kids Are Fine. 아이들은 즐겁다. Gentlemen, we have to end it there. We've been speaking to Jason Bechavez and Darcy Paquette for Movie Spotlight. It's been a pleasure to have you with us, as always.
Yeah, our pleasure too.
Take care.
We finish up now with Next Week from Seoul, our Friday segment where we take a look at some events and stories coming up in the week ahead. For that, our staff editor Mark Wilson-Che has joined us now in the studio. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
So what are we looking out for next week?
All right. More people in the country will be able to make COVID-19 reservations next week. Those aged 65 to 69 can make reservations from next Monday, and those aged 60 to 64 from next Thursday. Starting from yesterday, those aged 70 to 74 can make reservations. They can be either made by online or through new vaccination reservation call centers. I wonder where I heard that before. Oh, yeah, that was me, because you and I talked about this last Friday.
Yes, we did, yes.
So it's really great to hear that call center is being utilized. Inoculations for those age groups, as I mentioned, actually it's all under a single combined age group of 60 to 74, will be carried out over 12,000 medical facilities across the nation until June 19th, and all will be AstraZeneca vaccines.
Right, so the vaccine rollout is being expanded. Hopefully the supply can keep up as promised by the government, but that is a situation we will be watching closely as the days goes by. So what else have we got for next week, Mark?
The first trial in regards to the death of the 16-month-old girl Jung-in will be concluded next Friday afternoon. Jung-in's death, the following arrests, and the trial have been followed very closely by the Korean media and the public. In April, the prosecution sought out the death penalty for Jung-in's adoptive mother, surnamed Jang, who is charged for the abuse and murder of Jung-in. It also requested the completion of child abuse treatment programs, 10 years of employment restriction from child-related institutions, 30 years of tracking devices, such as ankle bracelets, and 5 years of probation. The prosecution also sought 7 years and 6 months jail time for the adoptive father, surnamed An, on child abuse charges. In addition to that, the prosecution requested 10 years of employment restriction from child-related institutions.
Yes, that hugely tragic story of Jung-in that we have covered on our show before. We will see what happens with the sentencing. That first sentencing is carried out next Friday afternoon, as you said. Okay, what else is set to happen next week?
Outgoing U.S. Forces Korea Commander General Robert Abrams will have his farewell event next Thursday and will receive a Korean name to boot. The Republic of Korea-U.S. Alliance Friendship Association will present the name Woo Byung-soo to the four-star general. According to the association, it's for Abrams' quote, contributions to the alliance and defense of South Korea. The first name, Byung-su, is made of the Chinese characters Byung, standing for authority, and Su, meaning excellence, while the city of Pyeongtaek, where USFK is headquarters, was chosen as the origin of the last name Woo, according to officials. So it's kind of fun. It's like saying that this general, this Korean name, he's originated. He's from Pyeongtaek, right? Mm. Army Pacific Commander General Paul LaCamera will succeed Abrams, but the exact schedule for the change of command is unclear at this moment.
Right, so we say farewell to General Woo Byung-su. Mm. That's all for next week, Mark. Thank you for that roundup, and we'll see you next time.
Yep, see you then.
And that brings us to the end of today's edition of Korea 24. We'll bring you the latest on Korea next week from Monday, as usual. So do join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news and analysis. Till then, thank you for listening. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great weekend. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.